We were just hearing some excerpts from the press event that Marina Abramović held this morning. And to pair, it's bringing up a lot of interesting questions, and I've been hearing some really interesting conversations around this area about what it means to watch a city change. I grew up in a neighborhood in New York City that is almost unrecognizable to what it was when I was a kid there and a teenager there. So I feel really, really sensitive to the reality of change that happens in places, and the tragedy of it sometimes, and also just the reality of it, that's what happens. But one of the people who I have found really helpful in trying to have a really grounded conversation about how places change is a social theorist and urbanist and actually a geographer named David Harvey. He's been on Democracy Now! A couple of times, so if you tune in at 8 a.m., you've probably heard his voice before. But he is a professor of anthropology at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and he's the author of a book called The Right to the City. And he is one of the main proponents of this idea that is called the right to the city. It's a concept that was originally articulated by a French theorist named Henri Lefebvre. The idea of the right to the city is sort of it talks about the city as an oeuvre, as a work of art that everyone in it is a creator of. And that, as residents of a place, we all have a fundamental right to helping shape that place and having spaces in that place that serve us. So this is a quick quote from David Harvey. He says, "The right to the city is far more than the individual liberty to access urban resources. It's a right to change ourselves by changing the city." So it speaks to our right to exercise a collective power to shape urbanization processes. So I think it's interesting, especially in seeing something like the Marina's project here, which is, you know, it's one building, but it's a major, major project, and it's really major for this city. And there's so much speculation about what it's going to mean for this place. And I thought David Harvey would be sort of a useful voice to bring into that conversation. And it's lucky because I just met him last Tuesday, which was really cool.
Huh.
I met him on May Day. I went down to New York City
to occupy,
but, and I went to actually Madison Park Square, where there was an event happening all day long called the Free University, and it was a collection of speakers and conversations and lectures that were taking place all day, and there was an actual program schedule, and you arrived at the park and their benches were each marked, and you could get a program schedule, and it would say at bench L you can hear Chris Hedges talk at this time, or at bench C at 10 a.m. there's a conversation about public space, or there's a conversation about student debt. And it worked. I feel like I've been to events like that where you get a program schedule and it's all so collectively organized that nothing actually really ends up being what people say it will, and you get lost. But I entered a number of really interesting conversations there. David Harvey was on the program schedule, so I went to hear him speak at 10 a.m., and I got to ask him a little bit about how his concept of the right to the city could be relevant to us living in the Hudson Valley, in small cities like Hudson, and also in more rural parts of our counties, and if he had some insight for how this concept of the right to the city might be a little bit relevant for those of us who are not living in major urban centers. So that was the question I asked him.
Let's hear some of it.
I'm going to first air a short clip of him on Democracy Now! Last week, just to get a sense, because she asks him sort of bluntly what he means by the right to the city, and he gives his own answer, so you don't hear it paraphrased by me. And then you'll hear my conversation with him, which is a little bit funny. But you'll hear my conversation with him directly after. So this is David Harvey on Democracy Now! Last week, on the day before May Day.
I'm trying to look at the history of urban uprisings. And actually, if you look at the situation around the world right now, you see examples in Bahrain, you see them in Cairo, you see them going on with the Indignados movement in in Spain and, of course, in Greece, and you see them in Chile. And in recent years, we've seen uprisings in places like Los Angeles 20 years ago. And so I'm interested in the sort of political significance of these movements. And I think in some ways, Occupy Wall Street is in that tradition. And tomorrow's actions, which are going to be decentralized all over the city, in a way is saying, let's take back the city and call it our city instead of being the city that belongs to the 1%. And so it's a bit like saying, let's have our city and make it our city.
You talk about the right to the city. What does that mean?
The right to the city means who has the right to New York City? Who can affect things here? Who can really change life here? And when we talk about the power of the 1%, we're talking about an extremely powerful group that actually dominates much of investment in the city, much of rebuilding of the city. We have a billionaire mayor who allies with them. But it's hardly a city that is run by picture the homeless or the impoverished population. So in claiming the right, in reclaiming the right to the city, what we're really trying to talk about is the way in which ordinary people can affect urban life and define a different kind of urban environment in which they're going to live.
I have a question. I live 2 hours north of here and use language around the right to the city a lot in thinking and talking about how we all participate in the making and changing of the place we are. But there are some real differences that when we're talking about public space up there, it's really different in a rural landscape, and it's often like it's the parking lot of Stewart's and not this kind of public square. And we do hit there's been some really interesting conversation about how and when that kind of language, urban centric language, serves us as a body politic, and when it becomes a little bit disorienting because that's not where we are. And I'm just sort of curious to know if you have any insight for us.
Well, you know, my view on this is there's uneven geographical development, you know, and the differences within New York City. I mean, the Bronx and they're mm-hmm. huge, and of course the difference between here and a suburban community or a peripheral mm-hmm. community. So we're always working in a context where there's strong differences, uneven geographical development. But I think that the way I stick with the right to the city thing is it constructs an image about an alternative body politic, you want to call it that, that is well organized and has some coherence. I mean, I think that the way I put it recently was, you know, our task is to try to create a socialist city on the ruins of capitalist urbanization. I mean, capitalist urbanization has created all of these peripheral zones, and it now extends right out into the rural areas. So the idea that there's some people out there who are living a peasant way of life, detached from urban, is not there. It's gone. It's still true in some parts of the world, but I spent a lot of time in Argentina. It's gone there. You know. So I think we just have to. I mean, I just work with this notion. There's uneven geographical development. Obviously, when you're organizing, you have to deal with the nature of the situation you're in. If you're in the Bronx, it's not the same as mm-hmm. being in Manhattan. But we try to see the unities between what we're doing and what everybody else is doing. And we don't, because we're talking about the right to the city, we're talking about the right of people to a decent urbanized life. And we're all living in an urbanized world now. That's how I tend to approach it. It's a little bit complicated, I guess. I get people often ask this question, well, what about the countryside? What about the rural? And I get to say, well, you know, the rural doesn't exist independently of the city, and the city independent of the rural. So you have to then think about the kinds of relations that exist. I mean, I gather that, you know, it's very interesting. If I go to the farmer's market, what do I see? I see upstate New York farmers coming in, you know. And so this is part of the chain that connects my life to their life.
I had sort of heard it in two ways. One is what you're saying, which is that our context there is still so defined by the urbanization that you're describing, by that to say or to talk about our urban situation right now is to include all of its tentacles because it's so... The other way that I was sort of trying to understand if, and this is sort of what you said a minute ago, thinking about a coherent body politic and that being necessarily peopled, that's what a politic is, and the thinking about the right to the city and the right to urban spaces, even in a rural context, speaking a little bit to the importance of people actually coming together to make sort of like coupling urban as peopled. Yeah. And I don't know if that makes any sense.
Well, I think, you've got to think about, organizing in your space. And of course, part of the difficulties I think we're now having in this movement is to think about the scale at which organization occurs. For instance, if we thought of the scale of a metropolitan region or a bioregion or something of that kind, then you're a piece of that mosaic. Mm-hmm. And then the question is, how do all of those pieces, which are easier to organize than the totality of the bioregion, how do those pieces fit together, lock together, how do they communicate with each other, and how is there some, this is what some people don't like to talk about, is there some supra level of governance that it relates then to all of the pieces, and is there
like
some governance of the whole,
right.
A confederation. Well, Murray Bookchin had this idea of mm-hmm. confederation of
libertarian municipalism.
Yes. Yes, right. And he has this principle, which I don't think can work very well, that the supra level assemblies should confine themselves to the government of things, not of people.
Huh. Does that mean?
Well, it means that they are not in a position to dominate what the people are doing, but they can organize the sewage disposal system. And
I see. So it's still within a framework of non-hierarchy,
non-hierarchy, but so you don't...
Right.
There's no hierarchy of people.
But there is
decision-making about how the water supply should be distributed amongst all of the municipalities and how the sewage disposal should occur so that I don't chuck my sewage into your backyard kind of thing.
Well, I wish I was a catfish swimming in a deep blue sea. I would have all you good-looking women fishing.